This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. If I say fall, you might say foliage or football. But for our guests today, fall is really about one thing, migrating birds. Yes, 'tis the season for about half the world's avians to get on the move. It's an annual show viewed with enthusiasm here in New Hampshire, especially the dramatic flights of big raptors like hawks, falcons, and eagles. But for birds large and small, migration has always been a perilous journey, and now made even more so due to human activity, from cutting down forests where birds used to rest to the broader impacts of climate change. Today in The Exchange, we migrate with the birds, and let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Tell us about the birds that you've seen migrating this time of year. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. David Patrick is here, Director of Conservation for the Nature Conservancy. And David, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Also with us, Becky Swamala, biologist with New Hampshire Audubon. And Becky, welcome back. Good to see you too.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Well, both of you, but I'll start with you, David. What do you love most about the migrations that you see this time of year? What do you find yourself just really looking forward to?
Well, I think, you know, the fall, that change in season for all of us is such a wonderful time of year, you know, coming out of summer and into fall. And for me, seeing the birds migrating through, it sort of, for me, it captures my own sense, of what's going on, you know, the changing leaves. And I love to see the birds coming over. I love to see, you know, the nighthawks, some of these birds we may not see at other times of the year coming through. And it's just a great transition and thinking about, you know, the things to come and the coming of winter. So it's a beautiful time of year.
What do you think, Becky?
Well, I get excited about all the different birds that you can see in migration. Summertime birds are breeding. Sometimes they're kind of quiet. Sometimes they're secretive. Fall, when you hit migration, the numbers of birds go up. You can see spectacles like migrating broad-winged hawks, or just in your backyard, you might have birds coming in you haven't seen before. Or for somebody like me, I love to go out and see shorebirds that are coming through in big numbers. Or even in the community gardens here in Concord, there are so many different birds gathered around. It's just great.
Well, and it's especially fun to see the big ones, the big raptors, and there's a lot of attention this time of year to raptor migration. Since you mentioned the broadwing hawk, Becky, let's listen a little bit to that. Again, this is a bird that is heading to the neotropics, as they call it, from Mexico down to southern Brazil. So again, that's a broad-winged hawk. What about other raptors, David? What do we see this time of year?
So you're seeing migrating ospreys coming through. There's even some chance we might see migrating golden eagles and some of these other birds as well. So it is a great time, as you pointed out, to see some of these birds that otherwise we may not be picking up on.
Why do we normally not pick up on them? They're just busy doing other things, or they're living elsewhere? Or?
Yes, it's a little bit of both. So some of these birds are, you know, they're out in the forest and they're hard to see. And as Becky pointed out, you know, they're typically dispersed out in the environment, so they're not out there in large numbers. So when they're migrating, they're concentrated in space. You know, and if we go to some of these, you know, particularly good spots, we can see them in large numbers.
Well, and when I think about the big raptors, Becky, I don't think of them as migrating in groups. You know, they seem more like solo flyers, so to speak. Do they?
Well, they fly solo, but they tend to all want to go in the times when the conditions are right. So we were hearing the broadwing hawk. That's a bird that on certain days in September when the conditions are right, warm air is rising, they ride those thermals up high and they migrate, but they tend to all go in the same sort of few days. So you can see more than 1,000, 2,000 broadwing hawks at some of our hawk watch sites like Carter Hill in Concord or Pac Monanoc in the Peterborough area. And when you get one of those big days, it's very exciting.
So kind of like a bunch of business people leaving, you know, leaving Logan Airport on Friday. They're all leaving because it's a good flight, even though they're not necessarily traveling together.
Exactly. And then you have other birds that aren't as dependent on those particular conditions, and their migration may stretch out over the entire season. So you could go up now onto Carter Hill. Most of the broadwings have passed through, but there are still other hawks, like the osprey eagles, are late migrants. They'll be coming in later in October and November. And we still have things like Sharpton hawks, Cooper's hawks, that will trickle through all during the season.
Well, I definitely want to ask you both about the eagles, because that's a really cool bird to see. And I saw a couple of them this summer out on the waterway. But since you mentioned osprey, both of you, let's just hear a little bit from the osprey. Again, wintering in the southern United States down through Argentina. Wow. Okay, and that's an osprey. And we're talking about bird migration today in the exchange. Since fall is the season for almost half of the world's species to get on the move, an annual drama viewed with enthusiasm here in the Granite State. We'd love to take your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, with your questions and comments about the birds that you might be seeing out there during this migration time. You can also give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. So, David, besides, you know, it's fun to see them, as you both said, you see birds that you might not normally see. Some of them are pretty magnificent, these big raptors. But beyond that, why does this matter in the bigger scheme of things, this annual migration story?
Well, so migration is such a critically important part of these birds' life history cycle. You know, without the ability to migrate, many of these birds wouldn't be able to be here. And so migration is important, but it's also a great time for us to get a handle on what's going on with these birds. So as we've discussed already, we have these concentrations of birds moving through, and we can count them. I mean, as we do in many of these points where we can count the numbers coming across, and then we can compare between years and start getting a handle on what's going on. And particularly, you know, of concern is if we're starting to see declines.
So give us a little bit more there. So you're tracking the numbers. You're seeing, okay, this year the population is 10% down or 20% down. What does that say?
Well, that tells us that there's obviously a problem out there somewhere. And one of the real challenges for us with migratory birds is figuring out where that problem is.
Right, and so, some of them have long journeys.
Exactly. And so, you know, that problem can be where they've been breeding along the migratory route, and where they're headed to their overwintering habitat as well. And so, you know, by getting those counts, we can detect the problem. And then the next question for us is figuring out, well, what exactly is the problem? What's the driver of the declines we might be seeing?
Now, the Nature Conservancy has, you know, offices around this country. But do you also go as far down as, you know, the Caribbean, South America and so forth? Because what if the problem is in Argentina or is in Mexico? It's not in this country. Is there a way to even begin to tackle it?
Yeah, so you know, as an organization, we work worldwide. So we have, you know, we have chapters across the United States, but we also have, you know, a presence across the world. And so we certainly are able to work, you know, across the range of these species. In terms of sort of tracking the problems, you know, it's the Nature Conservancy, it's Audubon, it's all of us working together. And, you know, we've had some great new science, some new techniques come out recently that has allowed us to follow these birds as they're migrating through. And that's something we weren't able to do before. So all of a sudden, we can track the individual movement of a tiny warbler all the way across its migratory route. And that allows us to get a handle on, well, what habitats are they using? Where are they stopping over? And to begin to get a handle on, well, where might the problems be occurring? And once we have that information, then we can start thinking about what can we do to address these problems.
Yeah, from what I've read, Becky, some birds are being outfitted with little almost GPS backpacks, right? And you can keep track of where they're going and what they do.
Yes, there's different technologies that are being developed, because the satellite transmitters, which you can use on things like osprey and have been used in New Hampshire to follow individual ospreys, they're too big for small songbirds. And so they've developed a new technology where you can put these little harnesses on the birds, and they have a data logger, data collector on them. You have to catch the bird again when it comes back to download the data, but they don't have to carry a battery, which is what makes a satellite transmitter so heavy. So we can recapture these birds, get the data, and find out where they have been on their migration. And there's been some fantastic information coming out from some of these studies. We have little black pole warblers here in New Hampshire. They weigh maybe 12 to 14 grams. if you have raisins in your cabinet, average size raisin is 1 gram. So 12 to 14 raisins in your hand is one
that's
small
a tiny
black
bird.
Hole warbler. It flies nonstop from our coast down to the Caribbean or South America.
Nonstop.
Nonstop.
Not even for food.
Not even for food, not for water, not for anything. And it's an amazing journey. It can take up to 36 hours of nonstop flight. And what these birds do is they put on fat in preparation for migration. So they might actually come close to doubling their weight. So think about yourself. If you're getting ready to migrate, you've got to double your weight. And figured out, and there's a place I stopped at where you could do a little calculator. I would have to eat more than 200 pizzas a day to double my weight in 2 weeks. Their whole physiology changes to enable them to make this flight of more than 1,600 miles in one nonstop flight.
And then they have to heft that new weight up into the air.
Get it in the air, and then they burn it. They use it up during their flight. And when they come back to land again, they are back down to a normal weight or just below the normal weight and may need to feed very heavily when they first get there.
You know, I was looking at some sort of discussion boards and so forth on this topic and came across one for kids where kids posed a question to the bird expert. And they asked some great questions, David, and I'll throw one at you. One kid asked, well, if the weather's better in the Caribbean and there's plenty of bugs and so forth, why don't they just stay there?
That is a great question. And you know, migration evolved because, you know, it increases the fitness of these birds, you know. So basically, by migrating, they're able to access resources, avoid competition in ways that increases the chances that they're going to successfully reproduce, pass their genes on to the next generation. So that's why migration exists. And so there's this tremendous cost to migration, this tremendous risk during that as well. You know, you're leaving the tropical rainforest. I mean, all of us head to Florida, you know,
right,
winter. So why would you leave, you know, leave and come back up north? But, you know, we know that these strategies have evolved because there is a net benefit to the birds. And so it's hard to see that net benefit, but the birds have figured it out, you know. And so for them, by coming north, accessing the resources available here during the summer, you know, that puts them in, you know, the best possible place to successfully reproduce.
Well, and as this bird expert told the child who posed this question, also, if all the birds stayed down there in the tropics, there wouldn't be such abundant food for them. How would you answer that question, Becky?
Well, think about what happens here in the springtime. You're outside. All of a sudden, there are bugs.
And good
there
point.
Are
black
huge
flies,
numbers
mosquitoes.
Of bugs. Mosquitoes, caterpillars come out. Explosion of this insect food. And that happens to a degree here that doesn't happen down in the tropics, much more steady in the tropics. This influx of additional food provides enough for these small birds to raise a family. So they have enough extra food to feed young ones and raise them. And that's what they're here for. They're here for that food.
So that insect banquet that we
yes.
see in New Hampshire every spring is enticing to them.
Exactly.
They know it's going to be here.
It works. The insects are here and they can feed their young. Their young will be able to grow. And then the young ones can feed on this insects, feed themselves once they've fledged until they're ready to migrate down south for the winter. But of course, in the wintertime, we don't have the insect abundance, so they have to get out of here.
Got it. All right. Well, the exchange number for you to join us with your questions and comments that you always wondered about bird migration, 1-800-892-6477. It's fall. It's time for many, many species of birds to leave New Hampshire and head to warmer climates. What have you seen in terms of bird migration so far? What are you looking forward to? Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And David and Becky, let's go to our listeners. And Steve is up first. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Good morning. I recently heard a lecture that talked about the incredible death of songbirds, that between there's half the songbirds between 1860 and now. And one of the things I want to give a shout out is I live in Nottingham. And what we've done is created through a land trust and some great sanctuaries and habitats for birds to stop on their migration and live. And it really points out the need for the ecosystem and the fact that we're losing habitat, and places like Nottingham are doing things to preserve it.
Steve, thank you for the call. Two points he makes. Becky, first to you, the decline in songbird populations.
There has been a decline in some songbird species. It's difficult to make a blanket statement, but many of the birds that spend the summer here and then winter down in the tropics, in the neotropics, as we say, in the Caribbean and South America, many of them are showing declining trends. Some of the other birds that stay around here are resident birds. Cardinals have increased. Tufted titmice have increased. So some of our resident birds have increased. Some birds that are short-term migrants have not changed. Short-distance migrants. They go down to southern U.S., and their populations may fluctuate depending on the winter conditions for them in southern U.S. You know, some years we have very cold temperatures in the southern parts of the United States, and that can affect some of the populations of those birds. So it's actually a very complex picture overall. And when you start adding in ducks and shorebirds and raptors, many of the raptors have increased since the early 1900s in the years of DDT. So it's a complex picture. There's no one answer there.
Well, and I want to ask you, too, David, what he says about creating bird sanctuaries. How do you even begin to do that?
Yeah, so I think the recognition...
To put it in the right place.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So the recognition that sort of habitat loss is this dominant driver of many of the declines we're seeing is, you know, the listener is absolutely right. And the question is, well, where are the places on the map that are going to be most important to conservation efforts? But the beauty with birds is we actually have really, really good data because lots of people care about birds. And birds are somewhat more visible, more vocal than many of our other organisms. So we have the data that tells us where are these birds spending their time, what types of habitat are most important for them. And those are the places that we can focus our conservation efforts. Here in New Hampshire, as with all of the states, we have a wildlife action plan. It's been developed by Fish and Game with input from biologists. You know, the best available science is captured in that plan. And that plan provides a blueprint for us across the state in terms of helping us understand where should we be focusing our efforts, where should we establish sanctuaries, protected areas, what are the actions that we can take to help conserve these species.
Go ahead, Becky. I can see you want to jump in.
Just want to check and mention that with small songbirds, there are many places they can potentially stop over, and it's much harder to get an idea of single spots that they need. Waterfowl, we can follow. We know the spots that they stop at. Shorebirds, they stop at the same places each year. Small songbirds are more dispersed over the landscape, and places like Northwood, where they protect a wide variety of habitat, is important as one piece in a mosaic puzzle that we really need to look at.
Well, how adaptable are songbirds, since our caller Steve asked about them, David? I mean, if there's a place where they stop and it's a great place for them to rest and get food, and then that place is paved over, how adaptable are they to find another place?
Well, I think as Becky just pointed out, you know, these birds aren't necessarily heading to one specific location. And so when we think about, you know, adaptability, certainly if we lose, you know, one place from the map, well, there are other places available. But the critical point there is that
if you lose 10 places,
yeah, there have to be other places available. And so when we think about, you know, sort of conservation and protection of lands, you know, we really do need to target to the ecology of specific species. You know, a really good sort of general rule is if we can protect large areas of natural habitat where there's a lot of variety in those areas, that's going to meet the needs for a lot of different species, our songbirds, you know, some of our upland birds, our mammals, you know, insects. And so, you know, there are times when we need to protect that particular place for that particular species and its needs. But a lot of what we're trying to do here in New Hampshire is to focus on, well, how can we protect a natural landscape that meets the needs of nature and of people?
How often do you find, David, here in New Hampshire, we hear about this elsewhere in the country, but conflicts between, you know, I want to build this factory, I want to build this shopping mall, I want to build this home development. And then groups like yours come back and say, well, this is a really important place for, you know, warblers or sparrows or owls or whatever. How often does that come up?
Well, I think there are areas of the state where we have a lot of people living and where we have a lot of people wanting to live. So if we think about, you know, our seacoast region, you know, the southern part of our I-93 corridor, you know, those are places where those types of conflicts crop up more regularly. And obviously, those are also places where we've lost a lot of these natural habitats, so the remaining habitats are even more important. And so the question, the challenge for all of us is, well, how do we balance those needs of nature and of people? You know, and so if we look at places on the seacoast, well, let's really think about planning for the future so that we can allow some, you know, continued expansion of our communities, but we can maintain their rural character, we can maintain those natural landscapes, and so we don't have that sprawl going on that we've seen in other parts of the country. New Hampshire's a really special place, and I think birds are this sentinel that allows us to think about how do we strike that balance and how do we make sure we've got the balance right.
Let's take another call, both of you. This is Jerry in Dover. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. First of all, I don't want to sound like a cat hater because I have three cats.
Three cats, okay.
All of my cats are indoor cats and a gigantic danger to the songbird population in this country are the cats that people allow to roam. Cats are natural killers and the domestication of the species has never bred that out of them. And people need to understand if they let their cat out, the cat is going to kill songbirds.
Jerry, thank you for the call. And someone just the other day, Becky, was showing me a whole book about this issue. People feel very strongly about the cat-bird conflict.
There have been some studies that have shown how many millions of songbirds cats do kill. And it is, he's right, they are a danger to songbird populations, cats that roam freely. And we kudos to him for keeping his cats indoors. We encourage people to do that. Because cats, no matter how well fed they are, these studies have shown they still will hunt like a wild cat would, and they still will catch songbirds and kill songbirds.
Well,
that happens all across the United States. So it's not just in New Hampshire or any one particular area. It's everywhere.
Since we've been talking a lot about songbirds, both of you, just, Becky, what are some quick examples of songbirds?
Songbirds is a general category of birds that includes most of the birds that you would see coming to your feeder. So things like chickadees, titmice, cardinals. Then there's a whole group of birds called warblers, which is my favorite group. They're colorful small birds that nest up in our area and go down to South America or the Caribbean for the winter. Then we have what are called the little brown jobs, the sparrows, group of sparrows. They can be difficult to tell apart. They're coming through in numbers right now during migration. And then there are some of these really colorful birds that people love, like orioles, rose-breasted grosbeaks, indigo buntings. They're also songbirds. So they tend to be very small birds.
All right. Well, more in just a moment on fall bird migrations. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. That's a Lincoln sparrow, which typically leaves New Hampshire in mid-October as it migrates to Mexico. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy, and we're talking about fall bird migration today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. What birds have you seen migrating this time of year? What do you still hope to see? And what basic questions do you have about just how some birds make these pretty amazing journeys? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests for the hour are David Patrick, Director of Conservation for the Nature Conservancy, and Becky Swamala, biologist with New Hampshire Audubon. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So we've been talking about songbirds and how it's their patterns are sometimes different from water birds or the big raptors. What are some of your favorite songbirds, David Patrick?
So I think, you know, for me, the warblers really are, you know, just incredible. I think, you know, Blackburnian warblers, these beautiful, like, flame-colored, you know, birds you see in the forest. Scarlet tanager, I think, you know, when you see these, you know, these birds against the backdrop of the forest, that just bright, bright red, you know, they're just absolutely stunning. And it's not just the visible birds, so it's also the songs, you know, that you hear in spring. And I think, you know, after the silence of winter, when you walk out into that spring forest, you know, wherever that might be here in New Hampshire, and you hear all of those different songs, all of those different calls going on, it's just magical. So, you know, for me, it's sort of all of those things together. Is, you know, I have specific species that I confess that I love, but really it's the, you know, the combination of all of these things out there.
Well, since you mentioned warblers, we've got the black-throated blue warbler. This bird winters in the Caribbean and departs New Hampshire this week around October 8th. Let's hear. Again, that's the black-throated blue warbler. I don't even really think about warblers that much, Becky. You know, when I see birds in my backyard, I see sparrows and the beautiful cardinals and blue jays and robins and all those typical ones. But I don't see warblers around my house. Or maybe I do and I just don't know what I'm looking at.
Well, warblers tend to be a little bit secretive compared to the birds that come to our feeders. They're oftentimes high up in the trees. And in fact, birders have a term called warbler neck. Which is what you get when you're watching for warblers out on a birding trip, because you're looking up. You've got your head bent up, looking through your binoculars, trying to spot these little birds that are moving around so quickly you can barely find them.
Warbler neck.
Warbler neck.
Okay, so yep. It makes sense that when David described what these look like, I was thinking, I don't think I've ever seen those.
No, and then the ones that are on the ground are oftentimes secretive and popping into the little bushes. So you might see a branch wiggle, but you don't see the bird. And one of the birds that's around, a warbler that's around right now, moving through in some pretty good numbers, is the common yellowthroat. And it has a black mask, the males do in the summertime. And then the young birds don't have that black mask. But they're one of the warblers that sometimes do sing in the fall. So you might actually be able to hear them doing more than just a little chip note.
Well, since you mentioned common yellowthroat, that's a New World warbler. Winters in Central America. And that's another one that will be migrating soon, later in October. Go ahead, David.
So I did want to say there are a couple of times of the year when I think you actually can see warblers. And, you know, for me, these are really special times. So when the warblers first come in spring, before we have full leaf out, you know, that's a great time to get out into the woods. And you stand at least some chance of seeing these birds before they're up in the canopy or down on the forest floor and they're hidden. And then just as, you know, sort of migration starts kicking in as well, we start seeing these species coming together in what we call these mixed feeding flocks. And it's another great time of the year to get a, you know, get a vision of some of these birds that you may not have seen for months. I really sort of really appreciate these two short windows of time when you go from just hearing these birds to actually getting to see them, because I don't have a very good ear for bird calls and bird songs. And so for me, it's like, oh, wow, this is what I've been hearing. So I really appreciate that.
Well, and some people wonder, Becky, why is fall so quiet? You'd think it's migration season and, you know, there'd be all this noise like there is in the spring. I mean, I know I'm often woken up at 4:30 in the morning by the birds in the spring. But except for those classic honking geese overhead, fall does seem kind of quiet bird-wise.
It is kind of quiet because those songs that they're singing in spring are to proclaim their territory and attract a mate. They're done with that now. They've done their breeding. They're not attracting mates. They're not holding a territory. So they don't need to sing. And in fact, there's this whole hormonal change going on in their bodies, which causes all kinds of changes. And part of it is a decrease our absence in song. And so what we do hear are little tiny chip notes, like the Lincoln sparrow that we heard, just a little chip, chip, chip. And they're being in contact with another bird. And you can actually hear these chips when they're flying over at night when they migrate. And these guys migrate at night, then they stop during the day to rest and to feed. So fall is actually the biggest challenge for birders when they're listening for birds and trying to identify them by sound, because they aren't usually doing their full song.
So fall is better for seeing, not hearing.
Correct.
So we talked earlier, both of you, and I'll start with you, David, about just some of the problems that birds have when they make this huge journey. I mean, a lot of them are going very, very far. You mentioned earlier just loss of habitat, loss of places to come on down and rest and eat. What other challenges do birds face these days when it comes to making that giant, important journey?
Yeah, so those challenges really start before they even start making the journey. So as Becky pointed out, you know, these birds need to put on a lot of body weight, but a lot of fat in order to make the journey, and that requires a lot of available food. So when we have situations where we've changed the availability of that food, for example, if we're using pesticides, you know, to control our insect populations, well, that's a problem to begin with, because then the birds are leaving without those stores of energy, you know, before they even set off.
So spraying for Triple E, spraying for Zika down in Florida.
Exactly.
You would not support that then?
I think with
from a bird's perspective,
from
anyway.
A bird's perspective, I wouldn't. And I think that, you know, there are informed and intelligent ways of going about this, and we need to really understand the consequences, and, you know, and use that to make informed decisions. So once they've set off on that migration, then we have, you know, we had the issues associated with sort of these stopover locations. And again, it can be habitat loss, it can be habitat degradation. So, you know, habitat that's just not as able to provide for their needs. We're also starting to see some effects of climate change. So we're seeing this, you know, an increased frequency of severe storms. And you can see this in the radar. So when these birds are flying, if they encounter one of these severe storms, they can be blown off course. Obviously, it's a lot more energy for them to move through that. And then when they arrive at their overwintering sites, you know, we have habitat alteration, loss, degradation going on down there as well. And so one of the real challenges for us with migratory birds is that often there's no sort of single silver bullet. You know, we have these combinations of stresses coming together that lead to these population declines. And so we need to understand all of those stresses and the interactions among those stresses in order to figure out what we should do about the problems.
Well, and the more I read about the journeys that these birds take, David, I appreciate what you're saying. So if they get blown off course, even just a little bit, it's a lot more for them to get back on course.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the margin of error for these birds is tiny. I mean, you know, when we talk about a doubling of weight, well, these are still absolutely tiny birds. And so we know that migration for many species, particularly our small songbirds, is an incredibly costly endeavor. And we see a lot of mortality. There's been work with our black-throated blue warblers showing that a very high proportion of these migrating birds, you know, die along the journey. So if you have something that's occurring more frequently, that's leading to greater mortality, you can do the math to figure out what the implications are for the long-term, you know, change in those populations over, you know, over time.
Let's go back to our listeners, both of you. And Chris is joining us from Nashua. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
So I used to live briefly in the South, and I was at the Augusta, Georgia airport one day in the fall, and I saw something I've never seen before or since. I looked up in the sky, and I saw literally a river of birds. It was this undulating river that stretched to the horizon. I have never seen anything like this. There were, I mean, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these birds.
Wow.
Flying in this river, and I was amazed. I didn't know what I was looking at. Is it all one species, multiple species? How did this get, like, organized? Do birds look up and say, ah, it's time?
There's the party. Let's join. What time of year was this, Chris, and where were you?
This was in the fall, and it was in Augusta, Georgia.
Okay.
And now, I also used to live in South Carolina. I'll just say as a side note, it was wonderful because, like, there were certain times of year where you just look out and there was all these gorgeous songbirds that would just pop up out of nowhere and be singing from the magnolia trees, and of course then disappear. But anyway, that's a minor point. But
wow, Chris, thank you for the story. And I don't know, Becky, what do you think? Do you want to speculate? Obviously, you weren't there.
No, but from what he describes, I think he was looking at blackbirds. So this would be a mixture probably of red-winged blackbirds, common grackles, maybe some brown-headed cowbirds. They tend to flock together, and they do fly in these sort of rivers of birds, and they oftentimes have a communal roost. There's one actually in southeast New Hampshire at the Great Bog where there have been over 200,000 of blackbirds that have come in the evening to roost. Starlings do form huge flocks, but they tend not to form these rivers. They tend to form a big swarm, and they'll put up and come down and put up and come down. If he's seeing a river of birds moving, I'm sure it's blackbirds. And they will come into cornfields, feed in cornfields after the fields have been cut, or even while it's still standing and they are dried out. But then when they move in these huge flocks.
Do birds tend to migrate in flocks or tend to migrate solo? We talked earlier, Becky, for example, about the big raptors, how they more go it alone. Is there a more common way to migrate, solo or as a group?
It really varies. With waterfowl, they tend to migrate as a group. With the songbirds we've been talking about, they tend to be solo. But again, when conditions are right, many of them will migrate at the same time. So they appear to be flying together, even though they're really individual.
You know, David, you talked earlier about the threat to birds, you know, habitat loss, getting thrown off by extreme storms and not having the wherewithal to get back on course. What do we know, David, about how birds are adapting to actual changes in the seasons, for example, you know, winter being shorter, spring starting earlier? Or this year we saw a very warm winter and then spring was just kind of cold and yucky until June or May. I mean, so what do we know about their ability to adapt to those conditions?
Yeah, so certainly it varies among different species. So we're starting to see, though, some general patterns in terms of which birds are better able to adapt to these changes and which ones aren't. And so, for example, where we have birds that are, where they're overwintering and their breeding habitat is closer together, so, you know, they're not making such long distance journeys, they seem to be better able to adapt and to respond to these changes. The real challenge is for these birds where, you know, they might maybe, you know, many thousands of miles away, and their timing, you know, they're trying to come back in time for this, you know, the insect outbreak, our black fly season, our mosquitoes that Becky was mentioning earlier. And in those cases, we certainly are, you know, seeing some what we call decoupling. So the timing of sort of one biological event, in this case, you know, the emergence of the food resource, isn't lined up with the timing of the other, which is, you know, the reappearance of the birds. And for those birds, it's really important that they come back at the time when the food is available. They don't want to come back too early because then they have no food and the risk of, you know, cold conditions and mortality, nor do they want to come back too late and miss that bonanza and not have the resources in order to have, you know, successfully raise their young.
And that bonanza time seems to be, again, it seems very different every year now. Sometimes, you know, winter seems to last forever, and sometimes you barely have winter.
Yeah, and that's really a great point. We tend to think about sort of climate change as a gradual shift, you know, so every year. And it's certainly, when you look at the averages, you know, it's coming a little bit earlier. But we're also seeing an increased frequency of these what we call stochastic or, you know, unpredictable events. So, you know, you can think back over the last few years, and we've had springs where, you know, it's been 80 degrees in March.
I remember wearing flip-flops one March, and then I wore boots until May of this year, you know.
Yeah, and so... And
I'm sorry, last year.
But in some ways, that unpredictability is sort of more of a problem than sort of a gradual shift, because for the birds, you know, that's a much harder thing to adapt to and to deal with.
Go ahead, Becky. Birds that are better able to adapt to these, you know... You can't count on the calendar anymore,
right,
to say, here's black fly season. It starts at this point in time. It used to be a little more regular.
Well, one of the species I study is the common nighthawk, which is an insect eater, and it comes back at the end of May. And we are seeing how they're adapting or not adapting to these unusual temperature swings in the spring, because they may delay nesting. And we've actually seen them do that. It, you know, early warm weather, the nighthawks return, cold, wet, they don't nest right away. Or they attempt it and then they fail. And so we think that this may be affecting potentially our aerial insectivores. These are the birds that feed on flying insects. Our swallows, the nighthawks, swifts are another group, flycatchers. This may be one of the events that is impacting their populations, because that whole group is declining at a fairly rapid pace.
So they're less adaptive to changes in the calendar, so to speak, you know, spring starting early one year and starting late another year.
That's what we're wondering about.
Well, I did read about some birds and that have kind of figured it out, you know, that they seem to be able to better sense that, oh, winter's going to be early this year or spring's going to be late this year. So I just wonder what you've noticed, Becky, in that area.
Those tend to be more of the short-term migrants or
as
the
David
residents,
said, yeah.
Yes, because they're migrating and they'll, if they're short-term, they'll go so far. Weather's still good, they'll keep going. If the weather isn't good, they can stop where they are. Or the residents, they may nest earlier in good weather temperatures and allow them to have more than one brood in a season when the weather is good and warm and mild. So they can sort of change what they're doing in a way that our long-distance migrants can't.
How does the satellite tracking that you talked about earlier, David, help us figure this out? And if it isn't helping us figure it out yet, how might it help us figure this out?
Well, I think, you know, the satellite tracking sort of gives us a kind of what we might term a coarse filter look at things. You know, we're picking up on sort of large aggregations of birds, and so we can get a general handle on what's going on. You know, again, if we have a storm, is it pushing, you know, a like the Atlantic flyway, we're seeing birds really shifted off track there. And so it sort of gives us a general sense. Some of the research that Becky was talking about earlier with these small transmitter, that gives us a much, much sort of finer understanding. What happened to that individual bird along that route? You know, we can literally track that over, I think it's every half an hour in some cases, we can get it. We can actually look at where that bird was. And so that really helps us, you know, if you think about it, sort of like you have these general patterns, it's like, well, you know, that tells us a little bit. But when you understand exactly what happened to that individual creature, that individual bird, we can draw a lot stronger inferences from this about exactly what's going on and what's really important.
How hard is it to strap that little backpack GPS tracker? I'm not really even sure what to call it. How hard is it to get that on a teeny little songbird?
Well, the folks that are doing this are really, really good at their job. And so, you know, when I've seen it sort of happening, you know, it's very carefully done. You know, these are birds that, as Becky mentioned, they have to be captured in the first place. So they're in hand. You know, they carefully attach the transmitter, you know, minimizing the stress to the bird because...
Right,
you know,
exactly. That's what I'm wondering about. They're delicate creatures and, you know...
Yeah, and that's always sort of a question with any kind of research is your research method influencing the thing that you care about, in this case, survival? And as best we can tell from this, you know, it isn't. It's certainly something that, you know, obviously the researchers are concerned about, but they really have perfected the technology. And these things are absolutely tiny because there's only a sort of a certain proportion of the body mass of the bird that you can add in the form of a transmitter.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's tough enough that they're making these giant journeys and then you're adding a transmitter on them. So I'm not trying to put down the effort. I'm just wondering what the impact is on the bird.
Well, as far as we know, these birds are making these migrations safely, and you know, we're learning a lot from that work.
More on fall bird migration in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. That's an American Red Start, which will leave the Granite State this week for its southern journey to Central and South America. And today in The Exchange, we're looking at these amazing story and struggle of bird migration. Join us with your questions and comments and observations about fall bird migrations. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Becky Swamala is here, biologist with New Hampshire Audubon. Also David Patrick, director of conservation for the Nature Conservancy. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, let's go back to our listeners. Sheila's joining us from Brookfield. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Yes. My name is actually Celia.
Celia, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. I just wanted to relate a short experience that I had witnessing bird migration. My sister and I took a trip to Canada. We were traveling between Quebec City and Rimouski on the, I guess you would call it, the southern side of the St. Lawrence River. There was a pullover area, and we pulled in, and we looked down over toward the river. There was a huge marsh, and it was white. It was completely white. And we were trying to, as we were trying to figure out what we were seeing, the whole of this white rose up.
Oh, wow.
And we recognized that it was probably tens of thousands of snow geese. It was an amazing sight, and I just wanted to relate that.
Sheila, thank you. Excuse me, Celia, thank you so much for the story. Go ahead, Becky.
Oh, that's an incredible phenomenon to see. I've seen 100,000 snow geese in Nebraska along the Platte River. And when they put up like that, it's you don't forget it. It's an unforgettable sight. And even in Vermont and New York, they have snow geese that gather there by 10 to 30,000 or so. So you can go over there and see them in certain places. And it really is a wonderful sight to see.
You know, since you mentioned and she mentioned snow geese, there's been some controversy, David. I think you know we're going to go with this about Canada geese and, you know, that sort of a classic fall picture of geese honking going over your head. I just saw some in my neighborhood last night, about 10 of them. It was kind of cool. But the geese are getting criticized in some communities for not migrating enough and for mucking up local parks and ponds. And can you just help us work through that?
Yeah, so it's sort of the irony. We've been talking about adaptation, and you know, we've changed the environment, you know, in such a way now that for some Canada geese, it makes more sense, you know, for them to stay put. You know, we provide resources for them year round. I mean, not intentionally, as you mentioned. And so, you know, so some of these geese are staying put. Some of them are still migrating, and that's just one of the consequences of, you know, of the changes that we've made to the environment. I do understand why people, you know, find the geese to be problematic through the winter. You know, I also think that, you know, seeing birds doing what birds do, you know, seeing them adapting is kind of a wonderful thing as well. And so, you know, we're sort of reaping, you know, the rewards of our actions there. But ultimately for the birds, it's all about survival. It's all about passing their, you know, their genes onto their offspring. So if we've created the conditions that increase fitness by staying put, and the birds are going to do that. That's the choice that they're going to make.
Interesting. Yeah, Becky, go ahead.
Well, we only have ourselves to blame for those local resident geese, because the ones which nest in the Arctic still migrate all the way down south. The ones that are local residents that are non-migratory are by and large descended from birds that we actually brought in to be non-migratory Canada geese. They were originally decoys, live decoy geese, so that the migrants would land among them and we could hunt them. And so now we have this whole descendant population that has thrived in these altered conditions. They like golf courses. They like lawns. They like fields. We provided the altered conditions. We provided the stock of geese. We've got them now.
Wow, there's a park where my husband grew up in New Jersey along the Raritan River, and it's just been ruined. Feels like a strong word, but sometimes when I'm there, it does feel ruined by these geese, never mind the contamination to the water.
And it's a challenge for places to try and figure out how to manage those local populations. And that hunting can play a role sometimes, and that can be extremely controversial.
Well, thank you for answering that question, though, because I look at them and I say, look, you're ruining this park. Why don't you migrate? Go somewhere. But you're saying they don't.
They don't. Nope.
Well, thank you for the call. And again, you can give us a call, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And here's someone who called in from New Boston who couldn't stay on the line. Sent an email, says she hasn't heard whippoorwills in years, then heard one recently, wonders if they had a decline and then have come back. Do either of you know about that, David or Becky?
Well, New Hampshire Audubon has had a project on whippoorwills, studying them with Dr. Pam Hunt. And there has been a decline in whippoorwills. They are still present in some areas in the state in strong numbers, and it's very much habitat related. There's a particular types of habitat that they like. They like open habitat and habitats that have some scattered trees or lower vegetation and an open area. So when the state was largely deforested for farming, that was a time when both nighthawks, which I study, and whippoorwills were much more prevalent in the state. As forests have grown up, that habitat change has made it less appealing to nighthawks and whippoorwills, but there are still some areas where they are found when where the habitat is still right. So Pam found that in doing some forest management, you could do some cutting such that whippoorwills would increase. And in the Ossipee Pine Barrens that the Nature Conservancy is involved in, the clearing to maintain the Pine Barrens in some of the regimes benefit common nighthawks.
David, go ahead.
Yeah, and I just wanted to stress that, you know, this is really, you know, a group of species where sort of active habitat management is vital. And, you know, as Becky mentioned, in the Ossipee Pine Barrens, we're actually using controlled burning there. And so, you know, what we're trying to do is to restore the disturbance regime that would have been found there. And that benefits the Pine Barrens habitat and all of the associated species found within that. So by restoring this natural disturbance, you know, restoring fire, which is often something that people see as, you know, as a bad thing, we've been able to really benefit this suite of species.
I want to ask you both about the bald eagle, because it's the American bird, because I love seeing it out on the Merrimack River, you know, swoop down and grab a fish. But a couple questions about the bald eagle. But before I do, let's just hear a little bit from the bald eagle. Again, the sound of a bald eagle, which stays in New Hampshire for part of the winter time. I was looking at that this morning. Becky, I'll turn to you first. Bald eagles seem to stick around unless it gets really bad, and then they go a little further south. So they're not really migratory?
They will go to areas where they can still find food, which tends to be areas of open water. So in the winter time, New Hampshire Audubon has a midwinter eagle count to try and get a handle on how many eagles are in different areas. And the main wintering areas are along the Merrimack River, along the Connecticut River, in the Great Bay Area, and in the Lakes region. So birds will congregate in those areas, but they will also travel, particularly young birds. You know, it's 4 or 5 years before a young bird breeds, a young bald eagle breeds. So those young birds will travel. They may go to New York to reservoirs there. They may go farther south along the coast. So they can disperse quite a bit. But there's no question that New Hampshire's wintering bald eagle population has been increasing, as has the breeding bald eagle population.
Well, let's talk about that real quickly, David. You know, we talked about all the challenges to the birds, you know, climate change and habitat loss and cats, you know, killing songbirds and so forth. But there are some good pieces of news about bald eagles and other birds here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, and I think those success stories are really things we need to keep in mind. You know, we have seen, you know, an increase in bald eagle numbers, you know, both as Becky pointed out, during the summer and during the winter. We've seen an increase in peregrine falcon numbers. We've seen an increase in ospreys. You know, our common loons have come back. Those successes have, you know, have been hard fought. They're due to a lot of, you know, really intense effort by some committed people across our nation here in New Hampshire. You know, dealing with DDT obviously put us on the right road, and making sure that there was enough protection in place to stop the eagle nest being destroyed, stop people poisoning and shooting our eagles. You know, we have the regulatory protection in place, and we have a population here that cares about these birds, that, you know, has a very different perspective to what might have been seen in the past. And we do need to, you know, celebrate those success stories while not resting on our laurels, recognizing that all of those species could turn around without continued management and attention, and that, you know, we have a long way to go with a lot of other species as well.
So, Becky, before we close out, what are some of the other species, as we talk about fall bird migration, that you really want to make sure we get out there?
Well, I just want to present a couple of really cool migration stories. From some of the research that's gone on, we know now that the Arctic tern, which is a small, it's a swallow-like bird, feeds on fish. It's our long-distance migrant champion. It travels 44,000 miles in 1 year from Greenland all the way down to Antarctica and back again, zigzagging across the ocean. That's a tremendous distance, and you can just imagine it's flying nonstop over water. There may be times when it spends a month on the ocean, right, in the open ocean. That's an incredible migration story. And then there's a shorebird called the bristle-thighed curlew. It's not from our area. It's in Alaska, and I actually got to see it for the first time last year on its breeding grounds in Alaska. But it flies to the islands around Hawaii for the winter. And it makes a nonstop overwater flight that could be between 6,000 and 10,000 miles in one flight. I mean, those are incredible stories that birds can actually do that, they can accomplish that. And then for people who feed hummingbirds, their overwater flight, they cross the Gulf of Mexico nonstop. That's 20 to 22 hours. And they're little tiny birds.
Oh,
they
yeah.
weigh 3 to 4 grams. That's it, 3 to 4 raisins in your hand. It's flying across the Gulf of Mexico. It's just amazing what they can accomplish.
Other birds you absolutely want to make sure do not get missed, David.
Well, I confess that my two on my list were the hummingbird and the Arctic tern. I used to work with terns and they are just absolutely amazing. And hummingbirds growing up on a diet of David Attenborough, but without actually seeing these birds, when I came to live in the U.S., and I mean, I am still mesmerized and amazed by these birds. But I mean, when I think about sort of incredible migrations, you know, I think about our Bicknell thrush is a great example where, you know, we think of it as this mountaintop, you know, sort of warrior here in New Hampshire. And yet it's spending its winters down in Haiti and Cuba and in the tropics, living it up in the rainforest. You know, and for me, that's, you know, it's sort of an amazing story, a bird that has two lives, only one side of which we see.
All right. Well, both of you, this has been great. Thank you so much, Becky. It was really good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Becky Swamala, biologist with New Hampshire Audubon. David Patrick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura.
David Patrick, Director of Conservation for the Nature Conservancy. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was written by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.